Bona tarda, anem a començar ja la darrera sessió d'aquest simposi. Avui ens acompanya l'Estela Dazzi. Ella ha vingut d'Anglaterra, és professora i és escriptora britànica, treballa en programes d'actualització del professorat i és consultora educativa en temes relacionats amb polítiques d'igualtat d'oportunitats. Ha treballat durant més de 20 anys i per tant té una experiència molt dilatada com a consultora independent especialitzada en la formació sobre raça i igualtat. És molt coneguda en els sectors de l'educació obligatòria i superior del món britànic, dels governs locals i dels serveis de joventut i té una gran reputació tant a nivell nacional en el seu camp. El 2004 va ser consultora del Departament d'Educació d'Habilitats per al projecte Apunta Alt, que tenia l'objectiu d'augmentar el rendiment dels alumnes afrocaribenys. També va ser membre de la Comissió de Patrimoni de l'Alcaldia de Londres i el novembre de 2003 va rebre el Premi de la New World for Black Manager per la seva contribució excepcional a la igualtat racial en la formació superior. El seu treball la porta a les escoles, instituts, universitats, autoritats locals, clubs juvenils i organitzacions de voluntaris tant dins com fora de la Gran Bretanya. Té una gran experiència en treballar en el Departament d'Educació i Habilitats, el Consell d'Aprenentatge i Habilitats, la Comissió per la Igualtat Racial i altres organitzacions governamentals. Ha format a governants, a mestres, a professors, a funcionaris, assessors i treballadors del sector del voluntariat des de finals dels 80 i és autora de diverses publicacions clau en aquest àmbit. Alguna d'elles també està, diguéssim, traduïda a l'espanyol. Bé, doncs, ella, per tant, serà la que ens impartirà la conferència Afrontar el racisme a les escoles, unes lliçons des del Regne Unit. Estela, i tu.
Sí, hola. My plan today is to explore the different ways that racism has been tackled in Britain's schools. Starting with the arrival of West Indian immigrants in the 1950s, and also to highlight what we've learnt along the way in the sincere hope that these lessons will be as relevant to teachers and education researchers in Spain as they've been to your counterparts in the UK. First, I'd like to give you some context. Like Spain, Britain's racial and cultural diversity is the outcome of a long history of colonialism and slavery. In the aftermath of the Second World War, with its indigenous labor force depleted and faced with the task of rebuilding and servicing its bombed cities, Britain turned to its empire for help. And just as the mother country had rallied the support of her colonies to help fight her battles during the war, Britain recruited its colonial subjects to support the post-war efforts to get the country back on its feet. London Transport needed men and women to run its buses and trains. The National Health Service needed nurses and porters and cleaners. In the industrial Midlands, factories were crying out for more workers. The government of the day turned to its colonies in West Indies, India and Africa, actively encouraging them to come to its aid. Throughout the 1950s, seduced by the promise of streets paved with gold, they arrived in their tens of thousands. And when it became clear that it would take a lifetime to acquire the wealth they'd been promised, they began to send for their children. Teachers in Britain's schools were totally unprepared. Raised on a diet of crude racism that saw black people as little more than monkeys, many regarded the first black children to step into Britain's schools and classrooms as a strange but temporary visitors who would eventually go back to where they'd come from. Consequently, there were no plans for their reception and no resources available to help with their integration. The policy at the time, if it can be described as such, was one of sink or swim. Black children like me, who were schooled in Britain during the 1950s, often described their experience as one of trial and torment. They faced merciless teasing from their peers, who made fun of their looks and the way they spoke English. They faced the trauma of adjusting to life in the inner cities, often in substandard housing, with families who they barely knew. And perhaps worst of all, they witnessed the total failure of their teachers to support, encourage, and nurture them. Instead, thanks to their teachers' stereotypes and low expectations, the first generation of black children to leave school found themselves equipped only to step into their parents' shoes and perform the low-paid, menial work that their parents had been brought in to do. Concerns about how to tackle racial discrimination in schools began as early as 1963, when Edward Boyle, who was the Minister of Education, declared in Parliament that on educational grounds, no school should have more than 30% immigrants. Boyle's law, as it came to be known, gave credence to the notion that the presence of West Indian or South Asian children in British schools was undesirable because it lowered standards. As in the United States of America, where the desegregation of schools had led to riots on the streets, some local authorities attempted to bus black children into other areas in an effort to dilute their presence. In the schools, meanwhile, teachers simply got on with it. If a black child kept quiet and did their work, however inadequately, they were largely ignored. If they didn't, they risked being labeled educationally subnormal and relocated to special classes or special schools to be taught alongside children with genuine special needs. By the time the Grenadian-born teacher, Bernard Coward, drew attention to the low expectations and discriminatory treatment of West Indian pupils in his book, How West Indian Children Are Made Educationally Subnormal Within the British Education System, this was in the early 1970s, educational policymakers were already describing the problem in terms of linguistic or cultural deficiency, ignoring the possibility that racism might be a contributing factor. It was left to black parents and enlightened teachers to campaign for measures to counter the effects of these attitudes. Where their concerns fell on deaf ears, many worked alongside black teachers and activists to set up supplementary schools or Saturday schools to enhance the inadequate education their children were receiving in state-run schools. Inspired by the message of self-reliance that was emanating from black communities in the United States, others organized black studies classes, home language tuition, or religious instruction within their own homes or communities. Others worked a double shift so that they could send their children to private fee-paying schools in the belief that these would give their children a better chance in life. In the state-run inner city schools, the efforts of a small but vocal group of teachers to promote a more multicultural approach slowly began to raise awareness of issues such as Eurocentrism in the curriculum and racism in the playground, paving the way for some important new developments. Their efforts were aided by specially funded staff employed, thanks to allocated government funds, called Section 11. These funds provided financial support to schools with a substantial number of so-called new Commonwealth or immigrant pupils. Now, although Section 11 teachers, many of whom were black, were primarily employed to respond to the children's language needs, they brought with them a greater awareness that eventually began to permeate other areas of the curriculum. Slowly but surely, mainstream teachers began mentioning the contributions of people from non-white cultures in their lessons and taking note of non-Christian festivals. But listening to Bob Marley in assembly, or showing children how to put on saris or play steel pans, proved easier than tackling the more challenging problems, problems like racial harassment in the playground, problems like widespread underachievement, and the disproportionately high school exclusion rates, particularly for African Caribbean boys. In most schools, this multicultural steel bands and samosas approach became a substitute for addressing the more thorny issue of institutional racism. By 1981, in the wake of serious public disorder confrontations between black youths and the police in a number of British cities, the Swan-Rampton Committee publicly acknowledged that institutional racism, defined as practices that may be adopted by public bodies as well as by private individuals, which are unwittingly discriminatory against black people, was a contributing cause of black underachievement in schools. Many local education authorities responded by appointing multicultural advisors to provide guidance and teacher training, or setting up multicultural curriculum support units where teachers could find the necessary resources. Others established specialist race advisory units whose function was often limited, due to their lack of executive powers, to the development of paper policies and the circulation of unenforceable advice. Many local authorities also ran compulsory race awareness training, often poorly conceived or ineptly delivered, spawning a defensiveness that would resurface 10 years later in a staff room backlash against political correctness. Throughout the 1980s, education authorities grappled with the challenges of an increasingly diverse school population. Anti-racism had become the buzzword, and a number of high-profile debates and inquiries helped to keep the issue of race and education in the public eye. The 1989 McDonald inquiry into the playground murder of schoolboy Ahmed Iqbal Allah at Burnage High School in Manchester had a particularly lasting legacy. Critical of the school's moralistic and doctrinaire approach to anti-racism, the McDonald report called for more sensitive, sophisticated practices that took account of other equally important factors, such as a child's gender, age, disability, social class, or physical appearance. This critique was seized upon by the British media as evidence that anti-racism doesn't work. The newspaper, The Daily Telegraph, went as far as to claim that the school's anti-racist policies had led to a killing, while other national newspapers condemned the Labour-led authorities for promoting an obsessive and divisive creed. This view prevailed, despite the best efforts of the McDonald team to reassert its conclusion that all schools should be informed by a policy that recognizes the pernicious and all-pervasive nature of racism and the need to confront it. Multiculturalism, seen as a softer, more palatable option to anti-racism, also became a target of media criticism. In 1992, when a white mother complained or objected to her child being taught Asian language songs in a Cleveland primary school, the High Court dismissed a complaint by our Commission for Racial Equality against the local education authority's decision to support this parent. Although the issue was Cleveland's refusal to acknowledge that the motives for this parent's objections were racist, the High Court's critique focused instead on the school's curriculum, particularly its teaching of language and culture. In doing so, it distracted public attention away from concerns about institutional racism and effectively condemned multiculturalism for detracting from, rather than enriching, the education of white British schoolchildren. Another ongoing controversy concerned the collection of ethnic data in British schools. The Department for Education had schools first collecting, then abandoning, and then reinstating ethnic monitoring, leaving education researchers and policymakers with large gaps in the data we relied on to assess performance and determine national policy. To this day, we face serious inconsistencies, both in relation to the ethnic categories used and the purpose of ethnic monitoring. The unacceptably high school exclusion figures for black adolescent boys of African Caribbean origin, for example, was voiced as an anecdotal concern by teachers, parents, and education pressure groups over many years. However, the statistical data that would confirm the extent of the problem and strengthen the case for more appropriate responses began to be collected on a national basis only 10 years ago. By this time, African Caribbean pupils were already 3 times more likely to be excluded from schools than their white counterparts. Debates about racism in education reached a watershed in 1993 with the murder of yet another black schoolboy, a promising A-level student called Stephen Lawrence, at a bus stop in Eltham, South London. Stephen Lawrence's killers were working-class white boys who had only recently left school. The fact that their fear of difference had led them to murder an innocent bystander was seen as a damning indictment of Britain's schools. How, we asked, could children go through 12 or more years of education with their racist attitudes unchallenged? In response to Stephen's murder, many people called for a national inquiry into the role of the police, who had failed to arrest the killers, and the schools, which had failed to educate them. The result, 6 years later, was the McPherson Report, which helped to revive debates about the responsibility of teachers and schools for tackling racist attitudes. 2 years before Stephen Lawrence was stabbed to death, government figures had revealed a marked increase in the number of racial assaults, threats, vandalism, and other forms of racially motivated abuse across the United Kingdom. 30% of these incidents had been perpetrated by children or juveniles under the age of 15. 3 years before that, in 1988, another major report had found that racial harassment was, quote, pervasive within the education system and a blight on the lives of students, parents, and staff. After 30 years of trying, the question of how best to tackle institutional racism in schools remained unanswered. The report's 70 recommendations included a welcome proposal that the national curriculum should be amended to promote diversity and prevent racism. And with the amendment of the Race Relations Act in 2002, this proposal became a legal requirement for every school and college in the country. Since then, Britain's schools and education providers have actively grappled with this requirement, some with considerable frustration, others with remarkable success. Their responses provide a rich resource for anyone with an interest in exploring strategic or practical solutions to the many challenges of tackling racism in their schools. In primary schools, for example, A range of dolls, toys and books have been developed to reflect the increasing diversity of the children we teach. Pupils can expect to access reading books in a range of local community languages, paints and crayons that represent the full spectrum of skin colors, and learning that links the local with the global. In less diverse schools, email and Facebook links are made with children in other countries or cities, ensuring that they develop an awareness of the benefits and realities of global, social and religious diversity from an early age. Whole schools have been known to support initiatives to challenge poverty, promote fair trade, or raise funds for disaster relief. And equally important, the children are able to educate their parents on these issues, thereby helping to raise social awareness beyond the school gates. There are also more explicit behavior codes, with teachers of all age groups required by law to discourage name-calling, harassment, and other socially unacceptable behaviors. Most schools have adopted a zero-tolerance approach to racism, whether from pupils, parents, or staff. Compulsory equality and diversity policies that outlaw racism and Islamophobia, as well as sexist, ageist, and homophobic bullying, have generated a range of classroom interventions designed to promote respect for diversity and to raise achievement. They include art and drama initiatives that raise the awareness of the consequences of racism, mentoring schemes to support underachieving black pupils, and recruitment drives to increase the number of ethnic minority teachers and managers in schools. These days, Ofsted school inspectors focus not only on issues of school management and teacher effectiveness, but also on the extent to which the curriculum actively promotes equal opportunities and discourages inappropriate attitudes. Strategic responses to this statutory requirement are supposed to be high on every school's agenda. Managers are expected to collect data on racially motivated incidents and on the achievement of different ethnic groups as a way of monitoring the effectiveness of their policies. Principals and head teachers have a legal duty to develop equality and diversity action plans showing how they intend to tackle discrimination and promote equality and community cohesion. In their schemes of work and lesson plans, teachers must now include evidence of how they are addressing these issues in the curriculum. Whether through Black History Month initiatives that focus on individuals and achievements, or through subject-based projects that highlight contributions and developments from across the globe, every area of the curriculum is expected to play its part. By addressing the concerns and the achievements of people from a range of cultures and religions, particularly those pupils represented in their own classrooms, teachers have not only helped to raise the achievement of ethnic minority pupils, increasingly they're seeing this as a core skill, preparing future generations for the multicultural society and the global economy they will inherit. Now, time does not allow me a more detailed description of the many innovative approaches and resources that have been developed in response to this agenda. But at the end of this PowerPoint, I've included a few useful web links for you, for those of you who are interested in following up. And you may also want to refer to my book, Toolkit for Tackling Racism in Schools. I have the English version here, but it has been translated, you'll be pleased to know, into Spanish. And it outlines many of these approaches in more detail. For those of you who are teachers at the chalk face, so to speak, Trial and Error, a curriculum resource I developed for the Department for Education, contains a wealth of practical ideas and classroom activities that could be adapted to the Spanish context. And details of these resources can be found on my website, which I'll give you. Now, with all these fine-sounding laws and strategies in place, it sounds as if Britain has finally solved the problem. Perhaps this is why, across the European Union, there are so many countries that look to the United Kingdom for answers. However, our journey has not been easy, and Britain has a very long way to go before it can really claim to be a beacon of good practice. Teacher resistance remains a major challenge. Without the necessary time, training, and resources, classroom teachers have not always supported or understood these measures. Many teachers see them as an unnecessary burden, particularly in a climate of austerity measures and budget cuts. Head teachers, already overwhelmed by the burden of paperwork required by the state, haven't always made the practice of tackling racism a high priority. Policies have often proved much easier to write than to deliver. So where is Britain now in 2010? The fundamental challenges haven't changed much over the years, but the context and the political climate have changed. With less and less power vested in the education authorities, and with individual schools now required to manage more and more of their own affairs, their financial resources, there's been a patchy and inconsistent response across the country to these laws and strategic requirements. In some schools, teachers have risen to the challenge. In others, the gap between rhetoric and reality remains unacceptably wide. Education priorities continue to shift as head teachers juggle the effects of inadequate budgets, damning inspection reports, and underperformance in school league tables. Teachers, particularly in inner city state-funded schools, often complain of burnout, brought on by the administrative burdens of our national curriculum, by staff shortages, by inadequate resources, and the constant pressure to produce academic results at the expense of other less marketable success criteria. Faced with insufficient time, staff room inertia, and genuine confusion about how best to confront these issues, even the most committed teachers have had to reconsider the demands on their time. For some, inevitably, anti-racism has dropped down the list. For others, it's become subsumed within the more palatable rhetoric of social exclusion, diversity management, education for world citizenship, or generic equality and diversity debates with no specific focus on racism. Black parents, governors, teachers, and advisors have watched these developments critically. They continue to voice concerns about underachievement, unjust school exclusions, and the failure of many British schools to meet their children's cultural, religious, and linguistic needs. Beyond the school gates, a media-driven campaign against political correctness has fueled public distrust, undermining local authority initiatives to promote anti-discriminatory policies and practices in their schools. The 1980s, when many Labour-run education authorities actively promoted anti-racist and other equal opportunities initiatives, is typically portrayed as an era of municipal lunacy. Fearful that they will once again be ridiculed for attempting to promote respectful language or a curriculum that reflects Britain's social and cultural diversity, and conscious of their electoral vulnerability, many local authorities have become less assertive in their efforts to tackle racism. So what have we learnt from all these developments? And more importantly, are there any lessons that could be useful to our Spanish colleagues and counterparts? Perhaps the most abiding lesson is that without adequate funding and commitment from the top, policies and endless reports are little more than paper tigers. Fine-sounding words remain empty promises unless teachers are given the necessary training and resources. Different approaches and contexts can lead to very different outcomes. So a clear vision, meaningful targets, and close monitoring are a prerequisite for effective school management. But of course, schools are only one cog in a very big wheel. And piecemeal initiatives are not enough. Our experience has shown that meaningful social change comes from a joined-up, multidisciplinary approach that actively promotes equality and respect for difference in all areas of public life. We've also learnt that to challenge racism effectively, every area of school life must be engaged. Success relies on a holistic or embedded approach that favours the carrot rather than the stick, and encourages parent and pupil ownership of the relevant policies. Our most resounding success stories have been in schools where teachers have used consistent messages and appropriate sanctions to transform not only the attitudes of their students, but the ethos of their classrooms. These teachers have relied on explicit policies, effective training, supportive head teachers, approving parents, enthusiastic students, and clear-sighted governors to keep them focused. And it's thanks to their vision and their tenacity that we now have concrete evidence of what can be achieved when a school sets out to challenge racism in a way that empowers and enriches their students' lives. I would love to conclude on that positive note. Despite the many initiatives I've described in this paper, racism remains rife in British society. Now, this is not to suggest that the schools have wasted their time. The progress they've made since the 1950s and 60s is self-evident. But it does remind us that a luta continua, that there is no room for complacency. In the current economic climate, black people, not just third generation immigrants, but Romani gypsies, refugees, asylum seekers, migrant workers, all of them remain easy targets. Instead of being recognized for their positive contribution or seen as a valuable human resource, they continue to be characterized as interlopers who steal jobs and steal homes from the indigenous population. As Britain, Spain, and other EU countries tighten their belts and prepare for the harsh times ahead, it will be as tempting as ever to blame outsiders for the problems we face. If we are to avoid repeating the mistakes of the past or stacking up problems for the future, tackling racism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia must remain a high priority in schools for many years to come. I hope that these lessons from the UK have convinced you that whatever hurdles you may encounter in Spanish schools, it is possible to make this vision a reality. Thank you. And I'm going to just show you some of the web links that you may find useful if you want to follow up anything in my talk. Thank you very much.
Is it okay?
Realment, no sé, deixeu-me que digui que penso que... que segurament en moltes coses doncs, també ens hi haurem sentit identificats, no? Aquest traspàs o aquesta evolució que ella mostrava de doncs, com en molts moments que també ha passat en el nostre país de les èpoques, en altres èpoques doncs, també es culpava l'escola de totes el que són les actituds racistes o xenòfanes, no? Els comportaments dient que una mala educació i per tant la responsabilitat es traspassava a l'escola, doncs això era la causa del que passava a la nostra societat, fins a plantejaments com el que ella mostrava ara, doncs, molt més multidisciplinars, dient doncs, que si no hi ha unes actuacions conjuntes la nostra societat, diguéssim, no canviarà i per tant no, diguéssim, erradicarem aquests comportaments. Ara bé, penso que en aquests moments segurament és preocupant i per això jo també voldria fer una pregunta a l'Estela en el sentit de que en un moment de crisi com estem nosaltres, bueno, i com està, doncs, estem a nivell mundial, en què és veritat que s'estan reduint els recursos de molts àmbits, des de la sanitat, a l'educació o la majoria de polítiques, què pot tornar passant? Això ens pot tornar a generar una involució respecte a comportaments racistes pot incrementar altra vegada actituds xenòfobes en la nostra societat o no? No sé.
I'm not sure. I heard all of it because I was having problems with my translation.
Vale.
But I think you were asking me if...
Sí.
Can you
just
repeat it for me?
Sí, vale. No, jo preguntava si en un moment de crisi com és el moment actual, en què s'estan reduint molts recursos, tant a nivell escolar, com a nivell social, com a nivell sanitari, per tant, moltes de les polítiques que es podien aplicar fins ara doncs segurament es veuran retallades, si això pot acabar representant una involució i, per tant, doncs, ens pot fer recular amb els passos que hem aconseguit doncs, per treballar contra el racisme i contra la xenofòbia. Si aquest risc el tenim més acusat, més agreujat, o si els passos que hem fet ja ens portaven en una bona línia i no ens han de fer patir.
I think there's always a danger during economic crisis to blame others for the problem. But I think it's also true that many of us recognize that this is not anymore an option. There is nowhere in Europe where we don't see the realities of multiculturalism. And as I often say when I work with teachers in Britain, this is not an agenda about being nice to outsiders or being pleasant to immigrants. The reality is we are mutually dependent and we're living increasingly in a global village, which means that many of the children who begin lives in our local primary schools will end up on the other side of the world, perhaps doing their jobs in countries in Africa or America or somewhere else. So as I said, increasingly, an awareness of racism and its dangers is an investment for all of us. And particularly an investment for indigenous children who should see their awareness of other peoples, other cultures, and the dangers of racism as a core skill, as important as the ability to type or the ability to speak another language. Does that answer your question?
Sí, sí, molt bé. Bé, doncs ara tenim mitja hora ben bona per, diguéssim, per debatre amb l'Estela tot allò que us preocupi o que vulgueu, doncs. Cris, en Xavier aquí davant.
Bona tarda. Ella ja ho ha dit que el seu llibre està traduït a l'espanyol. Doncs, afegiré doncs, que es diu Herramientas contra el racismo i és d'editorial Morata i com que no tenim encara gaires materials pràctics i contrastats com aquest, em penso que val la pena que se sàpiga, perquè si algú s'hi vol posar, aquí hi ha material per començar i fer bona feina. Jo li voldria preguntar un parell de coses. Una, hi ha tota una línia que quan es parla d'antiracisme es refia molt de les campanyes, campanyes públiques, un lema, uns esquetxos televisius o uns murals a l'escola. Des de la seva experiència, quina eficàcia, quin impacte, quin valor tenen aquestes campanyes, que a parer meu ho entenen poc, però m'agradaria saber quin és el seu punt de vista. I la segona cosa, justament en el seu llibre, fa una afirmació que aquí a vegades tenim poc clara, que és que diu ella que hi ha lleis molt clares que penalitzen els comportaments, els insults, les agressions, les actituds racistes, que a les escoles també hi ha normativa d'aquí en podríem dir reglaments de règim interior i altres coses, li voldria preguntar com s'aborda a les escoles angleses, com s'aborden els conflictes doncs, racistes. Quan hi ha algun tipus de comportament de part d'algun estudiant o d'algun professor qualificat de racista, quin és l'abordatge i quin recorregut fa. I l'última cosa, relacionada també amb el seu llibre, també afirma amb molta claredat que en aquesta educació antiracista hi ha una dimensió institucional i li voldria preguntar, en aquesta dimensió institucional, podria posar alguns exemples d'educació antiracista i una dimensió també curricular, i ella posa alguns exemples d'unitats i de temes doncs, que considera que haurien de ser que s'haurien de treballar en totes les etapes i en totes les edats, si podria també posar algun exemple d'unitat, de tema doncs, que consideri imprescindible de treballar en el currículum antiracista. Gràcies.
Was about public campaigns and TV. It's okay, can you hear me? I think TV is a huge impact on young people. And sometimes the message that we would try to convey in the classroom is contradicted by the stereotypes and messages that are conveyed through television programs and music and popular culture. We have a very difficult situation at the moment, for example, where we try in schools to counter stereotypes of different minority groups. But if you look at popular culture, and particularly the music that's popular with young people, hip-hop, gangster rap, for example, we are constantly bombarded with an image of black young men as gangsters and pimps and criminals. So I think for me this suggests that schools have an additional challenge because they are fighting not only the attitudes of parents but also the attitudes of people who children might regard as their heroes and sheroes. That's a slightly different situation to your question about public campaigns. I know from my own experience that in some schools, campaigns to raise awareness about issues such as fair trade, for example, have been hugely powerful in changing attitudes. And as I said in my paper, quite often, it's children who go home and then educate their parents. I don't know how many of you in the audience are smokers, but it's a similar analogy. Once the child has done the lesson in school about what nicotine does to a piece of cotton wool, quite often it's the child who becomes the educator of the parent. You also asked about laws that punish behaviors, and I think there's two sides to this question. Schools quite often have very clear codes of conduct for their pupils, and the reasons, I hope, have become clear in what I had to say to you. We've had too many children murdered or seriously injured in our school playgrounds in Britain for us to be able to shrug our shoulders and say this is a problem for outside the school gates. So the school rules are very clear. The challenge, however, is to empower teachers to administer those rules. And I don't know if you have the same problem in Spain as we have in England and in the United Kingdom generally, where our children are beginning to speak a very different language to the language of adults. Is that a problem here in Spain? I don't know. But what that means is that children have a way of insulting each other or teasing each other that goes over the heads of the teachers. The teachers don't get it. Yes? I'll give you an example. In popular culture, it's very common among black children to call another black child a coconut or a bounty bar, yeah? Which is a piece of confectionery. And what that means in popular parlance is that the child has a black skin but is white inside. In other words, he's not black enough for his friends. Yes? Most teachers wouldn't understand that. We also have the problem within our own black community of something that Alice Walker, the writer Alice Walker, referred to as colorism, which is making a distinction between the different skin tones. And basically that means that if a child is of mixed race or has a slightly less traditional heritage, they become a target of ridicule. So there's a real challenge for our teachers both to be aware of these issues and to know of how to challenge it. Particularly when you're talking about a white teacher challenging a black child for black-on-black racism. Now you ask me what happens if a teacher is guilty. It depends, I think, on the school, it depends on the head teacher, and it very much depends on how seriously the governors of that school take the issue. In some schools, it's a sackable offense. In other schools, a teacher could very well expect to be suspended from their job until there's been a proper investigation into what happens. But in many schools, the casual racism of teachers goes completely unchallenged. And it is still an issue for young children in schools that they experience not necessarily overt racism, because most teachers now are sophisticated enough to know not to be crudely racism in the example that as I gave you earlier, but certainly subtle racism, subliminal racism, messages that imply racist assumptions but aren't overtly stated are still an issue. And that, I think, is more difficult to challenge because often the teacher themselves are not aware that they're being racist. And I think the honest answer to your question is that in that situation, you wouldn't want to suspend or punish a teacher, but you'd want to do what you do with your children, which is to re-educate them or to at least make them aware of the dangers of such attitudes. Now, I'm a trainer. I go into schools, colleges, teacher training institutions most days of my life. And I do know that for many teachers, their own training is inadequate. So we in England rely a great deal on in-service training, which I guess is what's happening here today. Teachers who are already qualified coming out to be trained for a day, half a day, maybe longer, to discuss and consider how to address these issues. My personal feeling is that if you simply penalize someone for racist attitudes, then the problem doesn't get resolved. I gave you the example of Stephen Lawrence, which was a big case in England, this child being murdered by children who'd come out of school with their attitudes unchallenged. Now, it's quite possible that the school where those children attended said no to racism and threw those kids out. So it became a problem for the street. It wasn't resolved. And my life's work is about giving teachers the tools to challenge those attitudes in the classroom. so that it doesn't become a problem that then spills out onto the street. And I also believe that if that's to be done with sensitivity, that you have to do it in a way that is empowering of children rather than simply making them feel as if they're social pariahs. I talked about a holistic approach, and maybe I should have said more about that, but for me, there's very little point in simply tackling children's attitudes if you don't tackle the media and the parents and the other places where racist attitudes are generated. A few years ago, I worked on a project in South London where we were attempting to change the attitudes of young children who were identified as perpetrators of racist attacks. And I remember very clearly standing talking to a parent, a mother, who said, "I'm not racist, but," and you always count when you hear that but "I think if they sterilized all these people when they came into the country, it would no longer be a problem." Yeah? And her children were standing there listening to those comments. Now, I might want to challenge that child, but at the end of the day, I also have to challenge the attitudes of that mother. And I think that is the problem that we face as teachers. We don't necessarily have access to the parents. What we can do, however, is give children the tools with which to eventually challenge such attitudes, in the same way as a child will grow up and challenge all kinds of other attitudes that they hear from their parents. I think that's a natural process of growing up, that you eventually come to challenge your parents. Maybe not in Spain, I don't know, but certainly where I come from, that's part of what we expect children to do eventually. And if you give the children those tools, eventually they'll be able to draw on that reserve and find ways of countering racist attitudes. Now, your third part of your question was about the institutional dimension and some practical examples of anti-racist education. Let me start with the institutional dimension. By institutional, we often refer to what we call unwitting attitudes. In other words, attitudes that aren't deliberate, aren't intended, and sometimes it's simply about practices and procedures that have existed traditionally for a long time that no one has thought to question. An example might be a school that has a uniform code where there's a requirement that all the girls in the school wear a certain skirt or a certain length of skirt. Do they have school uniforms in Spain? Yes, okay. No, no. Okay, in England we still have schools where children are expected to wear uniforms. Maybe that has been the school uniform code for many years and no one's thought about it. But now you have a Muslim community that lives close by, and although the school isn't saying those girls, Muslim girls, may not come to the school, effectively it's preventing them from accessing the school because of its uniform code. Does that make sense? That's an example of institutional racism. I could give you others, but maybe we can talk afterwards. In terms of how we educate children, I think I would be a very, very rich woman if I knew all the answers to that. But what I do know is this. If I'm going to educate a child not to be racist, it's no use simply preaching at that child and saying, "Don't do this, don't say that." And among the most effective strategies in the classroom is to get ownership from those children by helping them to see the links between racism and other forms of social exclusion that affects their own lives. So when I'm working with a group of children, maybe they're crazy about football. I might start by saying, what do people say about football supporters these days? Or what have you heard people say about young people these days? And once the children begin to articulate their anger or their outrage about the unfair things that are said about them, it's a very small step to get them to understand how stereotypes work against other groups. I also think that we have to have a holistic approach in the way that we teach. In other words, there's no subject on the curriculum called anti-racism. That would be crazy. What we need is to integrate those messages into the subjects that we teach. So instead of teaching a history of glorious white conquest, or even black studies, which I think is past its sell-by date. In England, we have Black History Month, White History Year. Instead of doing that, we have to find ways of integrating these issues into the curriculum in a naturally arising way. And that means that when I teach history, I don't try and separate out the history of black people from the history of England or the history of Spain. I show that history in all its glory and all its infamy. And when I teach geography, I don't teach about Africa as a begging bowl, but I show the contributions that Africa as a continent and different African societies in particular have made to our thinking, our music, our dress, our food, and all the other areas of our own culture that have been influenced directly or indirectly by those other peoples from around the world. And when I teach mathematics, I tell children that there would be no algebra without the contribution of people from the Muslim world. Am I making sense? Please nod at me because I can't see you out there. Yes, every subject has dimensions to it which can highlight the roles, not just of black people. And I should have said earlier that when I use the term black, I use it in a political sense. It's nothing to do with skin color. It's to do with people who could experience racism. So when we use that term in Britain, we're referring to the whole spectrum of peoples from around the world who have ended up in Britain, not just people from African descent. There is no subject on the curriculum that is neutral. And the earlier we start, the more hope we have of putting in place an awareness, a sensitivity that will give the child the strength and the tools with which to challenge and analyze the racism they're fed as they grow to adulthood. Have I answered your question?
Hola, sí. M'agradaria preguntar-li si hi va haver algun impacte després de l'atemptat de Londres, si hi va haver una altra mirada cap als alumnes musulmans, de professors o de mateixos companys cap a aquests alumnes, si hi va haver un punt d'inflexió.
Yes, there was. And because we now have a requirement that we monitor racial incidents in schools, it was possible to measure the increase of Islamophobia in school playgrounds. I think the general increase in racial attacks on people who looked as if they could be Muslim, that doesn't necessarily mean that they were, was something like a 60% increase in that immediate aftermath of the London bombings. And we even had somebody producing t-shirts in which was written the slogan, "Please, I'm not a Muslim," which some of us black people wore almost as a kind of protest. So yes, there was a very definite upswing in the number of racial attacks, but there was also a government response, and every school in the country was sent advice by the Department for Education on how to address these issues and on the requirement that schools encourage teachers to talk about feelings and allow children in the classroom to discuss their anger, their fear, and the other sentiments that were generated by this outrage. And what this did was it allowed teachers to not only encourage discussion, but also to convey to children the very important message that not all Muslims are terrorists, and that terrorism, I suppose, for some people, is freedom fighting for another. I know I'm in Catalan, so I'm allowed to say this. One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. Now, I'm not in any way suggesting that the London bombings were justifiable. And I know from being a Londoner that all of us travel with a level of fear when we step into the underground. But by encouraging schools to address and confront these issues in the school, in the classroom, I suspect it helped to damp down some of the potential impact of Islamophobia in the school playground. We now have another phenomenon I was reading about just yesterday as I was traveling here to Spain on the plane. And that is a backlash from some young people who identify with the Muslim cause. I read in the paper that a child who had put something on his Facebook about how sad he was that his grandfather had died in the war was being targeted by children who identified with Al-Qaeda, so-called. I mean, these were young children, and who were threatening this child for his attitudes. So I don't want to give you the impression that we're simply talking about what we say in Britain, white on black racism. Absolutely not. This is a far more complex and sophisticated issue for us. And when I talk about tackling racism, I'm talking about tackling the racist attitudes of all groups, whoever they are, not only between groups, but also within groups. I hope that answers your question.
Moltes gràcies per la seva intervenció, que considero molt adequada als moments que estem vivint aquí. Però tenim un problema que li voldria plantejar. El seu llibre dona molts qüestionaris d'autoavaluació de centre per analitzar fins a quin punt el racisme està incorporat, o l'antiracisme als documents de centre, les pràctiques docents que s'estan fent, fins a quin punt s'ajusten a tot això. Però els assessors que van als centres, i segurament en aquesta sala n'hi ha bastants, es troben amb una dificultat prèvia, que és que el centre accepti la necessitat de fer aquesta avaluació, accepti que és possible que cometi actuacions racistes, que hauria d'avaluar-se, que hauria d'auditar els components racistes que hi puguin haver a les seves pràctiques. I aquesta consciència, aquest disparador inicial, aquest posar-se en disposició de fer aquesta autoavaluació no sempre es dona. Llavors, la seva experiència com a formadora i com a, amb aquests temes, què aconsellaria amb aquests assessors que van als centres per ajudar a fer aquest primer pas de veure la necessitat de reflexionar sobre això, la necessitat de no minimitzar comportaments amb l'excusa de que són petites gambarrades, coses de nens que no tenen importància i tal, i aprendre seriosament aquesta temàtica. Perquè crec que moltes vegades hi ha una espècie de comportaments políticament correctes de cara a l'exterior, però que de cara a l'interior de les aules i fins i tot de les pròpies sales de professors, nosaltres sabem que la realitat és una altra. Des de la seva experiència, com es pot fer aquesta sensibilització de cara a la necessitat d'avaluar tot això? Gràcies.
I think it's quite difficult for someone like myself, who is not that familiar with the Spanish system, to answer that question, but I'll make an attempt. First of all, I think if the only people who are raising the issue of racism in schools are outsiders, in other words, external counselors who are coming into schools, then to some extent you're bound to have a defensiveness on the part of a school who's being told by an outsider there's something wrong. So my first suggestion would be that the school has to own this agenda and not see it as something that's imposed from outside. If schools are trivializing the issue, then we have to find ways of raising the awareness of teachers and school managers of the dangers of ignoring these issues. In Britain, we have many examples of schools who've ignored the problem, who said, oh, if children fight because of racial issues, they must do it outside the school gates, it's not a problem for us. And of course, it has become a problem because the issue has come inside the school and we've ended up with children who've been murdered or badly hurt. And I think those examples, they may not speak of the Spanish context, but they certainly should speak to it. I'm sure that Spain, like other countries in Europe, is not completely free of racial violence. But I think the real issue that you've raised is about how you empower teachers. In my experience, most teachers are fairly liberal, most. They have an understanding of the value of anti-racist messages, but quite often they feel a little bit insecure, a little bit uncertain about how to convey these. And this comes back to training. It comes back to empowering teachers to know how to do the work. Now, we have all kinds of methodologies that we've tried. Some work better than others. But in my view, it's no use simply focusing on individual attitudes. And it is really, really important to give teachers a forum within which they feel safe to discuss and articulate their own fears, their own attitudes, and perhaps the views they were raised with as children, in order to begin to rehearse some of the issues that they will be confronted with if they take these issues on in the classroom. I was very surprised a few years ago when I was told that this book had been translated into Spanish. I said, Spanish? I didn't even know they had an issue in Spain. I thought the issue in Spain was about the Catalonians and all of this. So I was very pleased too, but to me, the book was written very much to address a British context. And as you've rightly said, the British context includes a statutory framework and now some very explicit laws that require schools to take this issue on. So I would be very careful in your context about taking these examples and trying to superimpose them onto the Spanish context. I would imagine that some of the checklists and some of the ideas in this book could be very readily useful, but they may need to be adapted and perhaps used partially, if not in full, to address the issues. My feeling is that the best place to have those issues addressed, as I've said, is not only in staff training, but also in staff meetings and informal discussions. And the most powerful way of challenging teachers' resistance to these messages is by making sure that your head teachers are empowered. Your head teachers are enthused. Your head teachers have a vision which they have the ability to convey to their staff. And I know from my own experience, where I've walked into schools where that is the case, you can feel the ethos. You don't even have to wait for someone to speak. You can feel that this school is a safe space, that this school is a welcoming space. And it begins with small steps. We call it sometimes window dressing, but they're important nevertheless. They're the messages of welcome in different community languages. They're the images on the wall of children of all backgrounds playing together, relating together, enjoying each other. Children are not born racist, you know. There's no such thing as a child who's born racist. They assume those attitudes. And I firmly believe that if you can learn racism, you can unlearn it. So the ethos of the school is very important. And that starts, as I say, with the languages and the images and the projects and the displays, and it moves on and in to what happens in the classroom, the way the teachers themselves model appropriate behavior, and also the consistency of the messages. I don't know in Spain if you have the same problem we have in England, but a lot of our schools rely on what we call supply teachers. Teachers who are just brought in to cover a sickness or an absence. It's no use if all the staff are very clear about the school rules, if you have 3, 4, 5 teachers from outside coming in for a day or two who have no awareness of this. Children can play on these differences and exploit them. So when I say consistent messages, I'm talking about everything from the way teachers are prepared to go into the classroom through to the messages that are given to the parents of children about the kind of school their child is going to be educated in.
Hi ha alguna altra pregunta? Bé, doncs, si us sembla, abans de tancar, deixeu-me dir dues informacions que m'han passat des de l'organització. En primer lloc, us recordem que ara, 6:45 del vespre, hi ha la projecció de la pel·lícula La Ola al Cinema Trifó i que podeu recollir les invitacions a recepció. I l'altre és que, si us plau, us agrairíem que respongueu l'enquesta de valoració i que la deixeu a recepció. Bé, doncs res més, tornar a reiterar doncs, el nostre agraïment a l'Estela per aquesta xerrada. Jo penso que ara comença un debat que encara ens hi quedaríem més, el que suposa també és que el cansament d'aquests 2 dies doncs, fan que ja doncs, estiguem una mica doncs, tancats. Gràcies per la conferència, gràcies pels consells i ja està.